You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 29th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll begin in China with inward investment and outward cybercrime, as we review the just-ended development forum and examine the fallout from the hacking accusations. The biggest election the world has ever seen takes place in India in April. We'll ask, with Modi assured of a win, just why is he locking up his opponents? Oppenheimer comes out in Japan today, over 6 months after its initial cinema release. Here's what the leading man said in his Oscars acceptance speech.
We made a film about the man who created the atomic bomb, and for better or for worse, we're all living in Oppenheimer's world, so I would really like to dedicate this to the peacemakers everywhere.
But how will the film be received in the only country ever to be hit by Oppenheimer's creation? The Italian fashion house Valentino has a new head. We'll investigate what the man who revitalised Gucci will bring to the brand. And
so the BBC's 70-something gardening guru Alan Titchmarsh had his trousers blurred on North Korean state television lest the march of socialism be diverted by the sight of his blue jeans.
And Jim Willer takes us for a spin around the more outre stories of the week. And finally, let's say a prayer for camembert. The cheese may be heading to extinction, but it's no less stinky. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The International Court of Justice has unanimously ordered Israel to take all necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies reach the Palestinian population in Gaza. The US is asking American companies to stop shipping goods to more than 600 foreign parties over fears the items could be diverted to Russia for use in its invasion of Ukraine. And Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison by a judge on Thursday for stealing $8 billion from customers of the now bankrupt FTX cryptocurrency exchange. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, let's begin with a wrap of news from China, and there's plenty of it. I'm joined now by Patricia Thornton, Associate Professor in the Politics of China at the University of Oxford. Good morning to you, Patricia. The China Development Forum, the CDF, the country's annual flagship business conference, took place this week. And on Wednesday, President Xi Jinping met 20 US CEOs and major business figures in the Great Hall of the People. It was his first such meeting in 4 months. Many European CEOs also took part. Amongst the visitors were senior executives from Blackstone, Bloomberg, Pfizer, FedEx. What was the main takeaway from this meeting, Patricia?
So, good morning, Georgina. In my perspective, the main takeaway from the meeting is that basically, despite overwhelming evidence that China needs to engage in economic structural reform, there's been little evidence that it's willing or able to do so. So, as you pointed out, China met and Chinese leaders met with numerous CEOs and other figures, public intellectuals, including Harvard's Graham Allison, the author of The Thucydides Trap, and it was a great photo moment for Xi Jinping himself. But the IMF director, Christina Georgieva, addressed the forum, and she told China that basically, in her view, China was at a fork in the road, and it really requires deep, thoroughgoing structural economic reform if it is to proceed. And of course, the premier, Li Qiang, did respond, but none of the responses coming out of China to date suggest that they are willing or able to undertake that kind of reform.
So Xi Jinping told the business people that China's economy hasn't peaked, its growth prospects are bright. But we know that last year's foreign direct investment into China fell to its lowest level for 30 years. Is Xi's optimism about the economy warranted, or is this an attempt just to calm jitters?
So back in December, actually, there was a Central Economic Work Conference held in Beijing in which the Chinese leadership announced a new theory called Singing the Bright Theory of China's Economy. And it was backed up by the Ministry of State Security, then requiring all party members to continue to sing this bright theory of the Chinese economy, which basically meant that everyone needs to speak well of China's future economic prospects or face some kind of punitive measures. So it seems clear to me that what Xi and other central Chinese leaders have been doing at the China Development Forum is acting this out, in very real and specific ways. But there are warning signs that they are just not getting the message from the IMF and from CEOs. And as you point out, foreign direct investment has fallen off dramatically. Just in the first 2 months of this year, it's dropped another 40%. So China is facing very serious headwinds to the China model of economic growth, which is really very quickly become outdated.
So how is China then trying to woo foreign investment?
So all that China has really basically offered is, according to Premier Li Qiang, was a new program of what he called ultra long-term bonds in order to help finance Chinese government debt. It was a $140 billion plan. And he also promised foreign investors and foreign companies in particular enhanced market access. So, and this has, of course, been a long-term issue with foreign companies in China. But beyond that, there was very little else that was more specific and more concrete. And furthermore, another worrying sign was that traditionally the China Development Forum concludes with a press conference and an open meeting between the premier and the CEOs, and foreign journalists are allowed to attend. But this year that was canceled, as it was canceled at the two sessions earlier in March. So what we're really seeing is a China that's resistant to change, continuing to securitize, continuing to lock down, and clinging to this old development model, very high investment, low consumption. And I think we're looking at some quite serious headwinds.
Mm. And China's firefighting on other fronts, too. There have been recent accusations over cyber campaigns by Beijing against New Zealand, the UK and the US. Can you give us the details of that?
Yes, absolutely. This has been an ongoing problem as well with China. The particular entity involved in the latest campaign is APT31. And this company or show company is a unit that has been said by Western intelligence to be closely linked to China's People's Liberation Army. It's been around since at least about 2010, and it's been linked to numerous various attempts to hack and glean and steal information and trade secrets from a variety of different entities. In this particular case, the UK and the US have both sanctioned. They've announced sanctions against ATPF, and they've raised their objections to China. But China has denied these allegations, as it always has done in the past. And in fact, the ultranationalist Global Times yesterday issued a statement declaring that the US and the UK were like naked women before China, just basically carrying on hysterically, but in a very vulnerable position. So China has certainly poo-pooed this, these allegations. It is said that the Netherlands Prime Minister Rutte mentioned this, and he raised it in his private meeting with Xi Jinping during the development forum. form, but it's not known what the outcome of that discussion might have been.
Well, so just picking up on Rutte, that's the Dutch Prime Minister, he was talking about restricting China's access to technology. She said that that wouldn't stop the country's advance, but the relationship between the Netherlands and China has become very strained over this export licensing on the sale of machinery that can make advanced processor chips. What's the latest on that?
So the dispute or the disagreement there revolves around the Dutch company ASML, and they have restricted, allegedly under some U.S. pressure, although the Dutch government has denied this, they are restricting the export of ultra-high-tech, ultraviolet lithography machines, which are required to make the latest generation of microchip to semiconductor chips to China. The Dutch government has said that it's not targeting China in particular, but China obviously feels that this is a measure that's designed to delimit their own growth. And again, there is a lot of tension there now in that relationship. Rutte is interesting, of course, because he's tipped to be the next head of NATO. So moving forward, his relationship with China and with this issue will be very closely watched. But more broadly, in the context of China-EU relations, there's been a lot of concern that even as China is trying to move up the scale and produce higher value and higher-end goods, high-tech goods in particular, there's been a lot of concern about dumping electronic vehicles and other kinds of solar batteries and everything, and that the Chinese overproduction and overcapacity in these key areas may further increase the deindustrialization of Europe. So European powers in general, and the Netherlands as well, very concerned about regulating these trade relations with China, if at all possible.
Patricia, thank you very much indeed. That's Patricia Thornton there. And this is The Globalist. On the 19th of April, India goes to the polls in the largest election the world has ever seen, with some 968 million people eligible to vote. The election takes place over several weeks, with results set to be announced on the 4th of June in the country that claims to be the world's largest democracy. But many believe the country is now an electoral autocracy under Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his right-wing nationalist BJP party, which is almost certain to sweep to victory for a record third time. More than two dozen opposition parties have formed a coalition bloc called the Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance, or INDIA, but are alleging that they're being politically targeted. This has come to a head with the arrest of opposition figure Arvind Kejriwal, the chief minister of the Delhi Capital Territory, and this is just the latest in a string of legal troubles for various prominent opposition politicians. Well, the journalist Maya Sharma joins me now from Bengaluru. Maya, many thanks for coming on The Globalist. Can you tell us about Kejriwal and his party and the facts behind his arrest?
Well, Arvind Kejriwal has been arrested in a case that goes back a couple of years regarding allotment of excise licenses, liquor licenses, in the capital region of Delhi. Of course, a very profitable enterprise indeed. The allegations are that he and members of his cabinet and other party workers of his party, the Aam Aadmi Party, received massive kickbacks in return for allotting these licenses. Now, of course, this is something they have denied, but his party colleagues have been in jail for several months now. And the most recent arrest was that of Kejriwal himself, a sitting chief minister, which, of course, is very, very unusual. And people are questioning the timing of it. This is a case that has been going on for quite a while. Now, with just weeks left for the elections to start, he is in jail. And in fact, he will stay there till Monday. His custody has been extended until Monday by the court. And it's not just that. The Congress party, of course, another major political party, they say that some of its accounts have been frozen because of income tax problems, which date back even to the 1990s. Now, the general feeling is that many of these organizations cracking down on the opposition are working on the instruction of the government to stifle the opposition.
And of course, this has caused an international outcry, particularly the arrest of Kejriwal. What's been the reaction of particularly Germany and the United States?
Yes, while of course the opposition parties themselves and some media houses, not many, have been crying themselves hoarse about what they say is the erosion of democracy at election time. Unexpectedly, perhaps for India, other international countries and of course other organizations as well have actually raised the issue. Germany said, "I hope Kejriwal will get a fair and impartial trial, as India is a democratic nation." Now, India did not take kindly to this comment. They summoned the diplomat. And later after this, he has said that he would not comment. They will not comment on this issue. The United States also said, "We encourage a fair, transparent and timely legal process for Kejriwal." And the MEA, the Ministry of External Affairs of India, took strong objection to the remark. And they said, in diplomacy, states are expected to be respectful of the sovereignty and of internal affairs of others. They were not happy. This did not stop the United States. And once again, the State Department said that they continue to follow the government's action in the run-up to elections, including Kejriwal's arrest. And he, the spokesperson added, perhaps rather cheekily, "We don't think anyone should object to that." But India did object and says, basically saying, just back off. This is our business. Amnesty International and the United Nations have also commented on this case.
Do you think that the harassment of the opposition suggests a nervous Modi is taking steps to better shape the electoral environment in his favour? Or do you think that the government's recent moves reflect confidence about the election rather than concern? Is Modi now so popular that he can do as he pleases?
Well, possibly both aspects are true. The opposition certainly feels that despite the tall claims of 400 plus seats in the 543-member parliament, definitely going to the BJP. That's what the BJP is claiming. They're saying that the party and its allies will definitely sweep to power. Why then the sudden action against opposition leaders and opposition parties with just days to go for the election? The opposition leaders say it's because of a sense of insecurity. On the other hand, the fear is there, and it has been expressed by many, that the BJP, the ruling party, the central government, feels that it can get away with pretty much anything it wants to. That is a real, really deep concern for many as we go into this election, which starts just a few weeks from now in April. So it could be a mix of both, really, that they want to make sure of the victory, which they say they are assured of, but also they feel they can get away with doing pretty much anything. Mm. And I don't think they expected the international reactions.
So Maya, tell me this. Under Modi, those at the very top of the wealth pyramid saw their real income double. We know that India has one of the highest income inequality gaps in the world, more than the US, Brazil, South Africa, worse than the country's own history under foreign rule. Why would almost a billion voters prefer to make the rich even richer when they exercise their democratic choice in April? What's in it for them? What's in it for the poor of India? Why would they vote for Modi?
Well, of course, you know, we have a first-past-the-post system here. So even if you're looking at the popular vote, you're looking at something in around over 30% who voted for Prime Minister Modi and his party last time round. So it's a question of who gets the most seats. Also, the party, the BJP, has appealed to the Hindutva element, the element of militant Hinduism. And since the majority of the population in India is Hindu, they are being asked to believe that Hinduism itself and the hundreds of millions of followers of Hinduism are under some kind of threat. That is something, opinion that is being fanned by the ruling party. Perhaps that could be one reason. But as you said, the economic disparity, the top 1% owning so much, allegations of crony capitalism, and a huge problem when it comes to unemployment of the educated. These are issues you would think the electorate would think about, but what actually goes on in the mind of the voter in the polling booth, well, that's really up to the voter.
We know that there is Russian money coming into the country too. Now, when Vladimir Putin announced that he'd won his election, he was warmly congratulated by Modi, who tweeted that he looks forward to working together to further strengthen the time-tested, special and privileged strategic partnership between India and Russia in the years to come. I wonder what this means for the Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba's first trip to India. Will he get any support?
Well, interestingly, the Ukraine Minister of Foreign Affairs, Kuleba, has arrived on the invitation of India. And he is, in fact, right now talking to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Jaishankar, in New Delhi. He is having a conversation with him right now. He has been invited here. Possibly India is kind of peddling down on the warmth of its relations with Russia, which, of course, as you mentioned, has been, it's historical. It goes back to the Cold War, the closeness with the USSR. And the Ukrainian minister did, in fact, say that India could perhaps re-examine this, that what happened in the days of the USSR, of the Soviet Union, might be history, and that looking ahead, perhaps India could reevaluate its position when it comes to relationships with Russia. Ukraine is very keen on its part that India actually takes part in the peace process. Ukraine has put forward many points for a potential peace process, and they want India to be part of this. They want India to attend a peace summit in Switzerland, which they say will give the summit greater credibility and perhaps help with India's clout in what's known as the Global South, that perhaps India could give greater credibility to that peace process. So there is a sense of warmth in this meeting. It is progress, definitely, because the same minister had strongly criticized India continuing to import Russian oil, and it actually said it was mixed with the blood of Ukrainians.
And just finally, is Ukraine a campaign issue at all for Modi?
I would not say so. Prime Minister Modi himself does, of course, very much enjoy any kind of recognition he gets from foreign countries, from Indians living abroad. But while there have been terribly sad cases of some Indians being tricked into going to Russia and actually fighting against Ukraine, some have actually died, it is a very small percentage of the population which has been directly affected. We've had Ukrainian students who were studying in Ukraine having been forced to return, medical students particularly, they've been forced to return. But I think the numbers involved are so small that it would not really be an issue that would be on the minds of the voters. At least in my opinion, I don't think the Ukraine-Russia conflict, although of course very serious, would be an Indian election issue.
Maya, thank you very much indeed. That's Maya Sharma there. Now, still to come on the programme.
So the BBC's 70-something gardening guru Alan Titchmarsh had his trousers blurred on North Korean state television lest the march of socialism be diverted by the sight of his blue jeans.
This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 7:22 here in London, 3:22 in Toronto, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Paul Waldy, who's Europe correspondent at the Globe and Mail. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let's start talking about two former and one current Democratic presidents. We're talking Obama, Clinton and Biden. What have they been up to?
Well, they held a big fundraising event for Biden's campaign last night in New York City, Radio City Music Hall. 5,000 people raised something around $25 million for the campaign, considered one of the biggest fundraising events ever, if not the biggest political fundraising event. So it's a big boost for the Biden campaign, which has really been on a fundraising whirlwind in the last few weeks, raising far more money than the Trump campaign. And of course, a lot of Trump's donated money has to go toward his legal problems, his legal fees and assorted bonds he's got to put up. So I think for Biden, this is probably a pretty good sign because, of course, in the U.S., money is really, really important in these presidential election campaigns.
Yeah. And I know we're going to be talking about this a little bit later on with Simon Marks on The Briefing. But I see a number of celebrities join them, including Lizzo, who's embroiled in her own sexual abuse case, I understand.
Yeah, Lizzo was there. Queen Latifah was there. They had quite a show. Stephen Colbert was doing kind of a question and answer with all of the presidents. So, you know, it was a big event. event, and it's kind of one of these celebrity events that the Democrats tend to rely on because they have better connections, I think, than the Republicans do in that world. So, yeah, I mean, it's a big boost for Biden on the sense on the money front anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the International Court of Justice, as we've been reporting in our headlines, has ordered Israel to unblock food aid to Gaza. Give us more detail on this, as reported in The Guardian today.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty significant decision by the court. It's an interim ruling. But what it does, it kind of follows up on the South African case against Israel involving allegations of genocide. So the court is now saying that Israel basically, that famine has set in Gaza, not a case that it might or it's going to, it has set in. And it's calling on Israel to do an awful lot more to unblock food aid. Now, of course, Israel saying it's doing all it can and there's security issues, et cetera, et cetera. But I think this is a pretty strong rebuke from the court. And it comes, of course, after the Security Council has raised similar questions and just the world in general is really questioning why food aid and why we see all of these pictures of trucks backed up at the border, including the border of Egypt, which, you know, has a peace treaty with Israel. It's kind of surprising that not more food aid is getting in. We're seeing horrible images of children starving in Gaza. So I think this hopefully will force some kind of resolution to this. And of course, the court did also say that, you know, Hamas has an obligation to release the hostages and pointed the finger at them as well. But really, the focus right now is on the humanitarian crisis.
Absolutely. But with the whole UN resolution being ignored, how can this possibly be policed at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think this is a ruling from the court. Israel recognizes the court. There's actually an Israeli judge on the court who was part of this ruling. So I do think Israel will take it seriously. I do think they're saying we're going to do the best we can. There are security concerns. So I think it's going to take a few days for all this to work out, and let's see how it happens. But, you know, I don't think Israel's going to necessarily flat out ignore the order.
Yeah. Let's go to the New York Times now, which is reporting on the situation, or the cataclysmic situation, as it says, in Haiti.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've all been following the news out of Haiti, and it's horrific. Now we have a UN report that's kind of quantifying just how awful things are getting there. They're saying that so far this year, of course, when the gang violence really took hold in Haiti, more than 1,500 people have been killed. And that's probably only going to get worse because so many arms are flowing into this country despite an arms blockade. A lot of weapons are getting in there. The gangs are basically running roughshod. There is no really functioning government. There's only about 600 police officers for a city of Port-au-Prince. And I've been there, and it's a big city and a sprawling city. So 600 police officers is nothing. So there's really no end in sight to this chaos. And of course, the attempts to form a new government have not gone anywhere. The UN peacekeeping group or agency group that was supposed to come in from Kenya hasn't gone anywhere. So really, Haiti's been left alone. And I think this report says that the people of Haiti are basically living in an open prison. They can't get out and there's no help getting in.
Because, of course, Ariel Henry, the former prime minister, was in Kenya trying to persuade them to send forces.
Yeah, and I mean, Kenya had agreed to that, but I think there was an outcry in Kenya about why they're going to do this. The UN had kind of sanctioned it as well. So I don't think Kenya's going to step up, certainly not in this mess. I can't imagine any country sending troops in there or any kind of aid in there in that sense. I know there's been some food aid going in. Canada, the U.S. and others are trying to get some food aid in, trying to get some help to the people there. But it's so difficult because, you know, there's really no way in and the gangs are running everything right now. And there's no sign of that letting up.
Yeah. Now, it is Easter Friday. Good Friday.
It is Good Friday.
Good Friday. So we can talk about Easter eggs.
Of course.
And an egg error in Orkney.
Yeah, this is a great story. It's been around it happened a few days ago, but I think that the outcome is pretty heartwarming. This is a guy named Dan Drayford, who lives in one of the small Orkney Islands, Sandy, only about 500 people there. And he made a mistake. He ordered 80 cases of Easter eggs, chocolate eggs, instead of 80. So obviously he had enough eggs for more than the population of the whole community. He didn't know what to do with them. So he set up a contest and said, all right, look, I will raffle off 100 extra eggs. But once the story got out of his mistake and his error, the world's really taken notice. And not only has he sold something like 3,000 tickets to this raffle, he's also run out of eggs. So many people have ordered the eggs from around the world that he's actually had to order more eggs. And now he's hoping to raise something like £20,000 for the Royal Life Saving Society up there. So it's a happy ending to what was a pretty bad story and something he thought he would get mocked over. Now he's being celebrated worldwide. So it's a happy ending.
Wonderful story. Paul Waldie, thank you very much indeed. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The International Court of Justice has unanimously ordered Israel to take all necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies reach the Palestinian population in Gaza to halt spreading famine. The new measures were requested by South Africa as part of its case that accuses Israel of state-led genocide in Gaza. The UN is asking American companies to stop shipping goods to more than 600 foreign parties over fears the items could be diverted to Russia for use in its invasion of Ukraine. Since Moscow invaded Ukraine in 2022, the US and more than 30 other countries have put in place a raft of sanctions aimed at degrading Russia's ability to wage its war by cutting off access to Western technology. Yet American components continue to be found in Russian weapons left on the battlefield in Ukraine. And Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison by a judge on Thursday for stealing $8 billion from customers of the now bankrupt FTX cryptocurrency exchange he founded. It's the last step in the former billionaire Wunderkind's dramatic downfall. A jury found him guilty on 7 fraud and conspiracy counts stemming from FTX's 2022 collapse in what prosecutors have called one of the biggest financial frauds in US history. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Following months of speculation, Valentino has named Alessandro Michele as its new creative director, sending ripples through the fashion industry. The lauded designer brings a track record of revitalizing Gucci with his eclectic and bold collections. So, what's in store for the Italian brand? Well, earlier, Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Teodosi, sat down with senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And Faye began by asking how busy this week has been in fashion news.
This week in particular, but throughout the last year or so, so many changes, a lot of creative directors stepping down from their positions, and a lot of industry speculation about who's going to get the jobs that are now opening up. So it's a constant, we call it a creative director musical chairs in the industry. It's a running joke. But I think you're right. This week in particular has been particularly interesting to watch all the changes with Valentino, with Dries Van Noten, a lot going on.
Let's talk about Valentino. They just announced the new creative director is Alessandro Michele, which we all know he was the creative director for Gucci. What are your initial thoughts on that?
You know, I think it's a great match. That was my initial thought. It's a match that really makes sense, and this hasn't happened in a while. I feel that Alessandro Michele is known for his love of color, for femininity, pattern, embellishment, and these are all things that are really part of the Valentino vocabulary as well. Also, Valentino is a Roman brand, and Michele is a true Roman at heart. In fact, when he was at Gucci, the whole design studio had to move to Rome from Milan because he would refuse to live in any other city. And with Valentino being sort of located in the heart of Rome, next to the Spanish Steps, in one of the most beautiful historic buildings, I think he's going to feel right at home quite quickly. And it will be really interesting to see him translate the Valentino codes, which is, you know, you've got the Valentino red, you've got all these beautiful feminine silhouettes and a lot of romance through his eyes. And it's also the first time that he will be able to do haute couture, which Gucci didn't have. And I think that's where he will really be able to play around and to experiment and then be his maximalist self and have fun. So I think it's a great appointment.
You mentioned the word maximalism there, but do you think he also has to be a little bit careful, perhaps, about how much maximalism he will do at Valentino? Because at Gucci, I mean, he was very good financially, I guess, for the brand. But then some people say that it was a little bit tired at the end. But what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. And like you say at the beginning, that sense of maximalism and quirk that he offered for Gucci really charmed people. I think even I'm a real minimalist, as you can see. I'm usually dressed in all black. but it's just, it was so charming to watch the way he played with color and embellishment and then layered on the accessories and the jewelry. Towards the end, it did get a little bit repetitive, and I think Gucci wanted to go in a different, more minimal direction, which is why they parted ways. He couldn't really follow the brief, or at least follow it in that the speed that they wanted him to. If he replicates that exact aesthetic, I don't think it would be a great result. People do want to be surprised, and Valentino does have a distinct look. It's not, it's beautiful, it's feminine. It can be a little bit more maximalist, but it's not so eccentric and quirky. But I think it is a new house. It's a new appointment. He's had quite a lot of time off to research and to take a break, to find new inspiration. So hopefully if he's going into it with a fresh mind, with a completely different team, new setting, we will see something different.
And in terms of what we can expect from him, I think you mentioned something very interesting before we started the interview. In terms of accessories, he could be very good for that, right?
I think so. I think Valentino is a much smaller business than Gucci financially, so it has a lot of room for growth. And I'm sure now that Kering has recently bought a stake into the business, so they will want to see expansion and growth. And they had a big commercial success with the Rockstad shoes and accessories, but that was almost a decade ago. And they never had the same level of success with anything since then. And Alessandro Michele, originally at Gucci, he was an accessories designer, and he created so many hits during his tenure. So I think he could come in and create that hit accessory that will kind of draw more attention and also create a lot of commercial financial success for the business.
That was Monocle's fashion editor, Natalie Teodosi, and our senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Now, it's Friday, which means it's time to hear Andrew Muller's unique take on what the past 7 days have taught us.
We learned this week that London, the generally pleasant city from which we broadcast, is in fact a vicious, unruly dystopia which has for 8 miserable years squirmed desperately beneath the boot heel of an autocratic ganglord. We learned that London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, who we believed a more or less ineffectual but nevertheless broadly affable functionary, who we were pretty sure we recalled getting elected in 2016 and then re-elected in 2021, is in fact an usurper. Who seized power. Well, quite. We learned this from an entrancingly deranged video released by the UK's Conservative Party ahead of the local elections they are going to lose in May, ahead of the general election they are going to lose sometime before next January.
London, a city steeped in history. But tonight, its ancient streets bear witness to a different tale. A tale not of kings and queens, but of crime and desperation.
We learned, for starters, that they weren't able to find a single British person willing to read this drivel out loud, which was at least somewhat heartening. But we learned, somewhat to our surprise, that London is basically all the worst things about Pyongyang and Port-au-Prince combined, and that its damned and terrified people must live as moles.
In the depths of these narrow passageways tread squads of ULEZ enforcers dressed in black, faces covered with masks, terrorizing communities at the beck and call of their Labour mayor master, who's implemented attacks on driving, forcing people to stay inside or go underground.
And we learned, as foreshadowed, that this and other things besides are all the fault of the Sadiq Khan junta, which has unleashed anarchy since that coup d'etat, which appears to have slipped our memory.
The Labour mayor seized power.
Oh my God!
I see death everywhere!
Oh my God!
Oh my God!
What is going on?
And we learned that whoever or whichever variant of ChatGPT wrote this twaddle understands little about the degree to which a mixed metaphor can undermine your text.
For people living life under labor, like the citizens of London, the scales of justice remain tipped in favor of the darkness, leaving them to navigate the shadows alone.
Our point being that scales are of limited use when navigating the darkness, indeed are actually likely to make it more difficult, what with all their oscillating and clanking and whatnot. What you'll be needing is a torch, failing that, a candle. Practical counsel with which I am certain the General Muttered Agreement crew would concur.
Yeah.
Anyway, we also learned that what this was for 1950s America... You ain't not going... This is for 2020's North Korea.
The critical thing about growing camellias in tubs is you must make sure towards the end of the summer in August not to let that compost dry out.
That chorus we made of people saying they're intrigued to see where this is going would be a useful tension-building device around now.
Mm. I can't wait
Interesting.
To see where this goes.
Okay. Tell me
Let's
more.
Let's see where this goes.
We learned, yes, that just as the young Elvis Presley had been decorously filmed only from the waist up on 1950s American television, lest his lascivious gyrations corrupt a nation's rosy-cheeked youth, so the BBC's 70-something gardening guru Alan Titchmarsh had had his trousers blurred on North Korean state television, lest the march of socialism be diverted by the sight of his blue jeans. Indeed. We also learned, while trying to nail this bit down more tightly, what Titchmarsh's show Garden Secrets sounds like in North Korean.
모두 잘라줘야 함께 쇠줄을 늘여 우치지대로 이용했습니다. 이제는 작은 수직 결박띠를 해체해서 가는 막대기를 떼버립니다.
But we were regrettably unable to locate any coverage of the controversy in Rodong Sinmun, the always diverting newspaper of the Central Committee of the Workers' Party of Korea, though we did learn therefrom that, and we quote, officials and working class of the Suncheon Cement Complex, the leading cement producer, have updated their peak year production level by displaying indomitable will and mental strength to the full. Quite right, and a big hello to our many listeners at the Suncheon Cement Complex. And in a pivot from our recurrent delight at broadly conservative politicians getting yelled at by broadly non-conservative musicians for using their songs as campaign anthems, we learned that former and possibly future US President Donald Trump had found someone willing to soundtrack his ravings, specifically this guy.
And I'm proud to be an American.
This guy being large-hatted schlockmonger Lee Greenwood, who we learned has teamed up with Trump to get into Bible retail.
I'm proud to be partnering with my very good friend Lee Greenwood, who doesn't love his song God Bless the USA, in connection with promoting the God Bless the USA Bible.
At which we may have learned, frankly, of conclusively convincing proof of the non-existence of God, as it's hard to know what would be a cue for a lightning strike if this isn't, given that when one measures Trump's personal, political, and commercial conduct against the Ten Commandments, one finds open and shut convictions, re-commandments 7, 8, 9, and 10, arguable grounds for indictment on 1, 2, and 4, at least questions to answer on 6, and we, for one whimsical news monologue, would necessarily bet heavily on his record in private vis-a-vis 3 and 5. We learn nevertheless that the Book of Donald has been packaged with bonus chapters.
This Bible is the King James Version and also includes our Founding Father documents, yes, the Constitution, which I'm fighting for every single day very hard to keep Americans protected. Also, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance are all part of this God bless the USA Bible, and it's just very important and very important to me.
A commingling there of church and state, which must be prompting seismic conniptions in the vicinity of the grave of Thomas Jefferson. We learned that the God Bless the USA Bible is, in a possibly telling judgment of its anticipated readership, published in large print, and is all yours for $59.99, not including postage. We learned, however, that at least one person has no need of it.
All Americans need a Bible in their home, and I have many. It's my favorite book.
And we learned that even on this holy day, we, for one humorous news review, did not have it in us to rise above repeating a previous, if less scripted, Donald Trump exposition on scripture.
Some people are surprised that you say that. I'm wondering what one or two of your most favored Bible verses are,
well,
and why.
I wouldn't want to get into it because to me that's very personal. You know, when I talk about the Bible, it's very personal. So I don't want to get into
There's no verse that means a lot to you that you think about or cite?
The Bible means a lot to me, but I don't want to get into specifics.
Even to cite a verse that you like.
No, I don't want to do that.
You're an Old Testament guy or a New Testament guy?
Probably equal.
Happy Easter to all who've heard of it. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller.
Many thanks to Andrew. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Now it's time for a roundup of news from the big screen. Our film critic Karen Krasanovich joins me in the studio now. Good morning to you, Karen.
Good morning.
Oppenheimer opens in Japan today. Now, it opened in cinemas, what, 6 months ago, something like that?
Yep.
It's taken all this time to open there, and I suppose not particularly surprisingly, it's controversial.
Yes, it has been. And there was, particularly when Oppenheimer came out and Barbie, the hashtag Barbenheimer was trending. People were finding it quite, a certain section of the Japanese public were finding it offensive that they were linking, you know, the father of the atomic bomb to a lighthearted movie about dolls. And there was, for a long time, Japan wasn't even on the very lengthy list, I was just looking, actually, of all the countries that Oppenheimer was distributed in. And finally, a distribution house called Bitter's End, who specializes, actually, in award-winning films and art house films, has taken it on and has released it in Japan. And I think what's interesting is that they said, read from their statement, after following months of thoughtful dialogue associated with the subject matter. And I think that that's good that they're actually taking the public view into consideration.
Yeah. I was just looking back at a sort of old copy of the Japan Times, well, a couple of weeks old, and they're quoting Kyoko Heia, who's the president of the Japanese the Japanese city of Hiroshima's International Film Festival. And he says, is it really a movie that people in Hiroshima can bear to watch? And so, as you say, a lot of soul-searching went on before this actually came to release.
But I think that this distribution house is doing a very good job, as they had special screenings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, and that was the middle of this month, and those would be probably quite limited screenings. But I think to gauge how people were feeling, and I think I read it, there's an article in Reuters where Teruko Yahata, who's a survivor and speaks quite a bit about being a survivor of Hiroshima, said that she felt that it was important that people see the film and to understand what it's like, or to not be afraid of this. And it's often the way, and you'll see this all the time with films, that people will have an opinion without seeing it.
Mm.
And it doesn't trivialize it. I mean, it doesn't focus that much, but what Christopher Nolan's script said and what he filmed is quite sensitively done, and it is quite horrible. And most of us have seen that, the real footage.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how many failed screenwriters do you know?
I know many. In fact, I think you're sitting in front of one.
Isn't everyone you know trying to get a screenplay produced?
Well, did you get yours done? I was wondering. I liked yours. I thought it had a great premise.
There is a 10-year-old, however, who yes. is getting his maid.
You
damn
know,
him.
The reason I love this story, and I know it's a bit of a froth. Okay.
Yeah.
And the headline was what? Just what Hollywood needs. There's a fifth grader called Connor Esterson who's been meeting up with 64-year-old screenwriters Nick Vallonga and 68-year-old bad boys writer George Gallo. Can I eat something? To develop a movie, a working title, is called Little Wise Guy. And they're talking at Home Alone Meets the Godfather. And of course, Connor, who's, you know,
10.
Not just 10. He goes, I haven't seen The Godfather. But he's also a slashy multi-hyphenate. He's also an actor. Had a starring turn in 2023's Spy Kids Armageddon. And so he just whipped up this 6-page treatment all on his own. And this is, okay, you can never be too young in Hollywood. And you gotta have friends who knows. So he showed it to a family friend, quote unquote, who happened to be a veteran producer. Saw it, had legs, I love it. And took it to these two other writers. So we will see what happens. But Connor says he really wants to direct. Bless him.
But it's very true. I just want to pick up what you said there about taking it to a family friend, because that is how Hollywood works, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I had a meeting with a musical producer yesterday, and it works like that in musical theater as well. It is because it's like book publishing as well. You know, trying to get something read and published is not an easy task. It's not for sissies.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, come for the dumplings, stay for the movie. Now, I've got quite strong feelings about this.
Okay.
You tell us the story and then I'll sound off.
Okay, I want to hear your strong feelings. I like your strong feelings. All right, the TCL Chinese Theater, which is known as the Grauman's Chinese Theater, it's a historic, really beautiful, inside and out movie theater, I'm speaking American, in Hollywood, is going to offer Chinese cuisine for people who want to watch a film and avoid the popcorn. So it's going to be done by a proper restaurant, Sea Harbor Restaurant. And then you can eat your dumplings or whatever they have on the menu in front of a 97-year-old pagoda-shaped venue. Isn't that nice? No.
No. Okay. If you want to eat, go to a restaurant. If you want to watch a movie, go to the movie. Do you know?
Don't sit behind Georgina if you're eating your dumplings.
Absolutely not. I just don't understand this obsession with eating in films.
I do. I do, because, well, number one, we love to eat and watch, because that's a big thing. And number two, we're trying to get a different market into the cinema.
Well, I get
so
that.
There is
but,
that.
But I mean, there's a whole thing about sort of mindful eating. Don't you want to look at your food? You want to think about it. You also want to look at a movie. You want to think about that. You're not eating in the dark. I mean, I just think that you're two things which your senses should be completely engaged in, being mushed together. You enjoy neither. Or perhaps for people like you, it's enhanced.
We just, you know, if you're American, you like to do it all at once. And we want to eat as much food as possible and see the biggest screen possible in the most beautiful cinema. And I think it's going to be lovely. I think it's going to be interesting to see what they're going to like. I'm just wondering if they're going to serve it in really noisy packages and it's going to smell a lot.
Well, that's the worry. I'm not being unreasonable here.
I can use chopsticks in the dark, and I'm sure you can too.
Really?
So it's, yes.
I could use them to stab someone in the eye in the dark, I'm quite sure. Karen, thank you very much for coming on. Let's not go to the cinema together, because I will get very cross with you. But for those who want to eat dumplings, well, you can now do so at Hollywood's oldest, most famous movie theatre. Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much for joining us. There is good and bad news from the world of cheese. And who better to break it to us gently than Patricia Michelson, the owner and founder of La Fromagerie in London. Patricia, many thanks for coming on the show. Give us the bad news.
Well, the bad news. This has been rumbling on for a long time, but in particular, it was relating to blue cheese and also to Camembert. But Camembert is in a worse position because the strain of Camembert mold that is injected into the curds is actually becoming extinct. It can't continue.
Why is that?
Well, over time, the strain has changed due to the manufacturers, the larger manufacturers, wanting to have a strain that is perfect in the sense that it's white and it's fluffy and it doesn't have any other little colours and moulds coming onto the outside of the cheese. They wanted just a lovely white fluffy mould. So actually reproducing something that is so specific and so taking away all the other funguses within that strain of molds that have to go into the cheese in order to get that fluffy mold, they are actually killing it.
And as you say, Camembert's not the only cheese to be affected.
No, it all started really and truly with blue cheese, with the Roquefort mold that is injected into blue cheeses. And there was the same sort of problem that they want specific style of blue molds into the cheese, so the serum that they are creating. There were several strains of the serum, and they found one from a blue cheese called a Bleu de Termignon that could actually help to revive the serum and to keep the serum alive. But with Camembert, it's been very, very much more over-manufactured. You know, there's huge manufacturers now making Camembert, and they are, you know, changing it all the time to make it into this, like, what they think is a perfect cheese, and they want this perfect white, fluffy, molded cheese, and that's not how it should really be.
And how important is Camembert to French life? I mean, how will they cope?
Well, you know, it's vast. It's a huge part of export as well as home market. They export it, and the shame of it is that it's now Camembert is now mostly owned, well, if practically all owned, by Lactalis, which is a huge dairy organization that controls it. And you're fighting all for many years. They've been fighting to try and preserve it, but it's, Mr. Macron understanding the seriousness of it. It depends how much he likes Camembert.
There is also some good news, though. So an homage to fromage. Tell us about the Cheese Museum.
Oh, yes. So this is interesting. Every year there is an event that goes on in Paris called the Salon de l'Agriculture, which is a fantastic thing. And it brings the farmers to Paris, and it's huge. There's all sorts of animals and everything, and there's always a big thing about dairy there and how it all works. So this museum is paying an homage to their dairy industry, which is quite ironic since the French are trying to kill it. It's going to show, the journey from the land and the animal to the table. And I think it's quite lovely, but also how Disney-fied is it going to be, and how real is it, given that there are so many problems now creating their most famous cheeses?
Patricia, your shop, La Fromagerie, is just round the corner from Midori House. It's obviously here in London. Do French and British people feel differently about cheese? Can we ever really feel their pain?
You will do. Because if I can't get the cheese to put on my shelves, you're going to be complaining, aren't you? And my shop is so different from a supermarket part of the supermarket selling cheese. You know, we go to so many lengths to give you the full story behind each cheese and why it's in season and where it comes from and the type of breed of animal that makes that cheese. And it's a huge part of not only life, but, you know, having the right foods to eat and made in the right way.
Patricia Michelson, thank you very much for joining us here on The Globalist. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvaney, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Emma Searle. Our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist returns at the same time on Monday. On Sunday, meet the writers. My guest is Tom Baragwanath from New Zealand. It's a murder mystery, but it's also a biting social critique. Do join us at noon on Sunday for that show. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.